Bambi's mom. Dumbo. Littlefoot and his mom. The fox and the hound. Guys, we are all in touch with our emotions here at Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert, and every single week we are talking about movies and the history behind them. And this week, we're talking about Inside Out. We're talking about our very first Pixar movie this week, and that's because we have an amazing guest this week. I'm talking about Agnes Arnold Forster. She is the author of a brand new book coming out called Nostalgia, a Biography. I've been following Agnes for quite some time on Twitter right now. She is a Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Edinburgh over in the UK. And we have the absolute best conversation. She's got this book coming out about nostalgia. It's coming out in April, on April 25th. And I was fascinated with the idea of how do you write a history of an emotion? And what does that do? And then you've got this Pixar movie that everyone loves that in a lot of ways feels like a return to form for Pixar, at least it did. And of course, there's a brand new sequel coming out to that in June. So we have the absolute best conversation, not only about Inside Out, the role of emotions and the development of the human psyche, the role of emotions in how we think about the world around us, in our own actions, but also about her work, this fascinating new book that's coming out. This was the best conversation. I absolutely love talking to Agnes. I think you're really going to dig this conversation. We got to go some really interesting places that we don't often get to go to here on this podcast. And I think that's a sign both of the brilliance of Agnes, but also of the curiosity we have about our own life and the role that nostalgia plays in thinking about the world around us and our own actions and things like that. So I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. It's really, really fun. It's a really cool conversation. So sit back and relax, because Inside Out is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Well, good afternoon, I should say.
Aren't we doing this? We were just talking before we started recording, right? It's like, yeah. There's a lie going on that we don't know what time it is right now. So if you're tuning in, understand that Agnes and I are very, we're not trustworthy people. I think it's probably, we're starting with a lie. So that's good. So I'm so excited to talk to you. I've been following you for a while. I don't want to sound like that. That sounds weird. Like, I've been following you on social media for a while. But you've got a new book coming out shortly.
Yes.
About nostalgia, right?
What's going on with that? It's called Nostalgia, A History of a Dangerous Emotion. And it is a big, sweeping gallop, I suppose, through 300-400 years of an emotion's history. Starts in the late 17th century, comes right up to the present. I'd say actually the last couple of chapters probably don't even quite count as history. And it's not global, but it tries to be pretty geographically expansive. I kind of range around quite a lot. And it's a trade book, so it's a book more for a kind of, I mean, I'm a proper historian, you know, I've got the credentials and stuff, but it's definitely written for a kind of bigger general audience in mind. So hopefully there's something for a lot of people in it. It was really, really fun to write. And yeah, I'm looking forward to being out in the world and also, you know, slightly trepidatious, but it was a fun journey to go on at the very least.
Well, I'm very excited about this for a couple of different reasons. I had seen that you were writing. You had kind of talked about the process online and things like that. So I kind of started following and I was like, wow, this sounds really, really cool. And I reached out to you. It's like, hey, we should do a movie. It's like, let's do Inside Out. And you were like, page 6 in your book, you mentioned it.
Yeah. It's right in the introduction. I mean, it's one of my favorite films. I mean, that predates like the book, and also predates, I suppose, even my interest as a historian of the emotions. But it is a great explanatory device that I use in the book. And I use it quite often, actually, when I'm writing about the history of emotions, because a lot of people have seen it. It's, you know, an accessible film. It's great fun. And, you know, I really do think it tells us a lot about the emotions, and it tells us a lot about how some people think about the emotions, and it's a good kind of, I don't know, other side of the coin for how it's basically not quite how I think about the emotions. And so it's a good kind of counterweight to my view of the emotions world. But that doesn't make me love the film any less. It's a great film.
No, I have so many questions for you. I think that like this movie kind of allows us to kind of talk a lot about your work. I had a chance to kind of preview a little bit of it in the last few days. And I have to tell you a secret. So the trailer comes out the other day. I messaged you. It was like, oh my gosh, the trailer for the Inside Out 2. And then I looked, it's like, oh my gosh, we're recording on Sunday. And I hadn't realized that. I had gotten so carried away. I hadn't seen Inside Out until 2 days ago.
Oh, no.
So I felt like the student who is doing all the work like the night before was trying to get everything into my brain real fast, and which is weird because I love Disney. And this felt like, I was saying this the other day, this movie feels like a return to like the quality of Pixar films that we saw. Like,
yeah.
Remember how Pixar used to be like an event?
Absolutely. I can't believe you've never seen it. It's such a great film. I mean, you know, you don't even have to be in any way interested in, you know, anything I'm interested in to think it's just a great, like, it's such a sort of sweet and touching film. It's so emotionally, and it's so funny. Like, I think some of the funny bits in that film are some of my favorite funny bits of any film. It's just great. It's so charming. I've seen it all the time. I always watch it on planes if I'm on like a long, like, overnight trip or something. Because it's always good. It's, you know, feel good. But also, you know how, I don't know whether this is universal, but I feel like it is, that if you're on a plane, you're much more likely to cry when you watch a film. And I think like Pixar, you know, is good at that in general, and Inside Out is a real, you know, gets you in the feels, especially when you're at high altitude. So yeah, it's one of my favorite return to, I watch it a lot.
Well, speaking of crying, like we'll get to Bing Bong in a little bit. But you know, you're absolutely right. I don't know, Agnes, if the fact that I'm now like in my mid 40s means I am less inclined to be in touch with my feelings, or I'm even more inclined with my feelings. That whole like, what is it? The male thing, like a male crisis kind of thing. So not having that, but maybe I'm going to sit at home and watch a whole bunch. Like I'll start with A Bug's Life or something like that.
Oh, also a great film.
Oh, I love the movie. All right. So I used to work at Disney World actually. So
really?
Like wow. I have, yeah, I love Disney. So, all right. Before we get into your book and before we get into this movie, let's introduce you to our audience and kind of go from there. So, if you will, tell us about yourself, who you are, and what you're doing here.
Sure. I'm a historian. Mainly, I'm a historian, or rather, originally, I was a historian of medicine and science and healthcare. And I'm still a historian of those things, but I've added emotions to the kind of roster a few years ago. And I work at the University of Edinburgh, although I live in London, at least for the moment. And yeah, I'm British, as you can probably tell. And I have published a couple of other books. I did a book about the history of cancer. That was based on my PhD thesis. And then I did, just last year, had a book published about the history of surgery, about the kind of strange, kind of cultural history of surgery, like the sort of strange myths and stereotypes around surgeons, and had a lot of like sort of surgeons on TV, in film, in fiction. And then this is my, Nostalgia is my latest book. It's also my first kind of trade book. And yeah, I suppose, you know, I can talk forever about all the sort of boring things I've researched and written about, but I won't. But yeah, that's me.
Oh, no, we will absolutely talk about the boring things you've researched. I am very excited to talk about your research because you have done a lot of work. One of the things I really dig, actually, is that this upcoming book is a trade press. I'm the biggest fan of trade presses. This sounds weird because I'm working on a university press with my own first book, but I don't know that when we talked at, I don't know that we give trade – this sounds weird. I don't say this in a way. Right? I love trade presses. I think they're far more important than any other form of press because I feel like this is our opportunity to get out. And if I write to somebody and I write in a university press and the same 70 people who have been the same conferences that I've been going to for the last 2 decades have been there, I don't know that I'm changing anything. Who am I introducing the work to? And frankly, trade presses read better to me. I don't know. Did you find a difference in writing for a trade press versus a university?
Yeah, totally different. I mean, my second book was what they called it. It was for a university press. It was for Manchester University Press, but they called it a trade crossover. So it was supposed to have a kind of bit more of a wider appeal. It was priced a bit lower, that kind of thing. But fundamentally, I still basically wrote it as an academic book. And, you know, those things, academic books, academic presses, they have their place. I'm not, you know, I think And for a lot of people, that's what they want to do. And that's how, and they have to do it. You know, there's still a certain requirement, I think. You know, it's very difficult, if not impossible. I mean, in the UK anyway, can't really get permanent jobs without an academic monograph in history. But that all being said, I much preferred writing this trade book, partly because it's kind of more enjoyable, freeing, liberating experience. Obviously, you kind of research it, you read a lot of other people's work on the subject, you know, you read a lot of historiography, but you don't have to do quite the same slightly painstaking, you don't have to pay quite the same kind of painstaking lip service to historiography that you do in more academic fora. And which is, you know, again, that's the genre, you have to do that, that's fine. But it's just, there's something more kind of, I don't know, yeah, I think liberating is the right word. And I also loved being edited. So when you write an academic book, obviously you'll have an editor. But in my experience anyway, they don't really kind of get into the weeds of your writing. You know, they're not actually there to edit. You know, you get peer review and they'll make kind of general comments about the whole thing. But no one's there kind of really editing your text, at least not in my experience. I published with two different presses in the UK, so I imagine it's not like wholly. It's probably not just me who had that experience. But when you write a trade book, you have an editor who like actually edits kind of line by line and like really goes through and really kind of talks to you and discusses and debates with you about like, okay, well, does this chapter work? And obviously that's like, you know, a lot of work, but I loved it. It was so much fun. And it really felt great to have someone, it felt like someone else was really invested in the text.
That's awesome. I am so excited for you for this book to come out. For the world to be able to see it. It's coming out in June, is that correct? April, I'm sorry. This is perfect too because of the timing of this pod and then the new movie's coming out as well. So before we get into our excitement for Inside Out 2, why Inside Out? Of all the films that we could have talked about, why this one? Why was this one resonate with you so much?
Well, I think it's because it has this, you know, it really amazingly captures this model of the emotions and does it for a big general audience. Obviously, it's not a film designed to teach people about basic emotion theory, but it does teach people about basic emotion theory. And that's partly because basic emotion theory, which I'll explain what that is in a second, it's partly because basic emotion theory is kind of the common sense understanding. It's kind of how most people think of emotions. But what I think is really interesting about it is that that's not how historians of emotions tend to think about how feelings work. And so Inside Out is great because partly because it sets you up really well as a historian of the emotions to kind of talk about like why our interpretation differs. But also it does all these other things, like it talks about whether you can kind of neatly categorize emotions as like positive or negative. I think Inside Out deals with that question really well. It talks about the relationship between emotions and growing up, like childhood and development. And obviously that's a big subject of psychological study, but also a big subject of historical study. And it's also just great. I mean, there's not really, you know, I suppose that's, you know, not a very compelling like intellectual answer, but I just really like it. And so I like kind of, if people read my book and they're like, oh, I don't know what she's referring to with this Inside Out, maybe I'll go watch it. I'm like, okay, great. At least I've done one good thing in this world. You know, someone's done something. Someone's going to get something really good out of reading my book, even if it's not actually my book. So yeah, I like that.
Are you kidding me? Your book is about to be the companion piece for Inside Out and Inside Out 2. We're gonna work out a deal with Pixar here in a bit.
Yeah, I need some merch, don't I? I need to kind of get some sort of tie-in deal.
Are you kidding me? There's gonna be so much swag. The thing is, like, would nostalgia merch be in like sepia toned? Is my question.
Well, it's funny you said that because that was something I was really when I was talking with my publisher about how to do the front cover of the book. That was something I really didn't want. I was like, I don't want a nostalgic cover to my book about nostalgia. Because I was like, that's kind of the point of the book is that, you know, to be alert to nostalgia or to be kind of, I sort of say that the book is a rehabilitation of nostalgia. So it's not necessarily critical, but it's supposed to, you're supposed to be skeptical. And so I didn't really want this kind of like, you know, a sort of sepia toned, exactly kind of, oh, the good old days kind of vibe. And so, yeah, that's the problem with merch, nostalgia merch. It doesn't really, yeah, you need to think carefully about the visuals. I need to work on this. I've got a couple of months, so I'll get back to you at the end of April with that.
Fair enough. We're about to open up our own HATM merch. So I'm trying to figure that out as well. Like there's going to be a whole shop of like nonsense as well. So I'm trying to figure that out. I have all these questions for you about how I didn't even know that you could write the history of emotions. So this is fascinating to me. And I want to get into that here in a little bit. Before we jump into that, we have five emotions in this film. And you talk a little bit about emotion theory and, you know, these basic emotions and these arguments over which are the basic emotions. Can we talk a little bit about what these emotions do? We're kind of centered around this relationship between joy and sadness who kind of offset one another.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about what these emotions are doing and what their roles are?
Yeah. So if anyone's not seen the film, the two kind of main characters within a main character are joy and sadness, and they form part of a cast of, as you say, five emotions. Those are disgust, anger, and fear. And they live in the brain of an 11-year-old girl called Riley. And she's the main character, but most of the kind of action takes place behind the scenes, kind of in her brain, in her mind. And they are kind of in a kind of like control center of Riley. And they're about, they're kind of the whole purpose is to keep Riley kind of ticking over and to kind of, you know, manage her feelings, manage her kind of psyche, her personality, her sense of self. And they have these things called like islands, which are about islands of Riley's character. So there's like Goofball Island, there's Family Island, and these are supposed to be like fundamental structures of who Riley is, and the emotions are there to kind of tend to that. And they also involved in like memory. And so they'll have these things called core memories, where if Riley does something particularly kind of profound, you know, she has like a kind of great day out with her parents or whatever, that'll come in as a core memory and get stored sort of deep in Riley's self. So it's a kind of like, you know, obviously playful reconstruction of how the mind works in a child. Although we do also get glimpses that her parents also have the same five emotions, who are also sitting up in their brains, kind of managing them. So the idea is that, like, it seems from this in this world that everyone has these five emotions, these same five emotions sitting up behind your eyes, you know, doing stuff, making sure things are working and that people are relating to each other properly and that people are, you know, being good people or feeling good or feeling bad or whatever it may be.
I kind of wondered, looking at one of the interesting dynamics, I thought was like they were making very clear choices within Riley as far as the gendered dynamics of each of the emotion. You know, they had to pick, you know, whether joy was male, female, non-binary, anything like that. Were you picking up on that as well when you were watching that, as far as the choices being made, as far as who, what's representing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the thing that's like, you know, interesting about it, well, there are obviously loads of things that are interesting about it, but joy, sadness, and disgust are all female, and then fear and anger are male. Or at least, you know, that's how they're kind of, they seem to read. And I suppose it's not that surprising that someone like anger would be male. That sort of fits with our stereotypes of rage, I suppose. But it's interesting to me that, I mean, disgust, I think, you know, you kind of could have gone in one of two ways. But she's a bit of a background character. I mean, definitely the two kind of key figures are joy and sadness. And they're kind of, the sort of tension between those two feelings is like, you know, the kind of main dynamic. And they're both female. Which again, you know, you've got like the sort of sunny disposition of joy, and you've got the like, you know, ennui or kind of misery of sadness, and tears, obviously. These sort of like highly expressive emotions are often coded female, or very like, you know, big feelings, I suppose, are often coded female, aren't they? But yeah, I mean, I actually haven't really thought about it a huge amount in those terms. And so it's interesting that was like something you picked up on so quickly. I suppose you've worked it much more recently than I have, although I did rewatch when we first agreed to this. I was like, oh, I should rewatch that. I was also trying to convince my baby to watch it with me, but he's 9 months old and so has no idea about anything and cannot at all sit through a Pixar film. I don't know what I was thinking, but I was like, oh, nice colors. But no, you got like 2 minutes in and then had enough.
So. Oh my gosh, it's coming. I had, when my older son was a little boy, when he was like two, we had to watch Cars, which is my least favorite Pixar film of all. I I just hate that movie so much, and a thousand times. So it's coming. Like I'm sure you've already been warned. You're about to pick up on something that he loves. Where does nostalgia fit into all of these? Is nostalgia an emotion? Is it a memory tinged with emotion? What is it?
A great question, and it very much depends who you ask. So obviously Riley doesn't. Well, not obviously, but Riley doesn't have a nostalgia in her brain. So I suppose I should probably explain. I've been kind of referencing basic emotion theory, and just in case anyone doesn't know.
Please.
What that is kind of a way of thinking about feelings thought up by this American called Paul Ekman in the 1950s. And the thesis is basically that we all have a set of basic emotions, and that these are biologically bound, inherent, they are culturally stable, they're found in people all over the world, regardless of what kind of communities they live in, what kind of languages they speak, and that they are recognizable between cultures and communities, and that they often give the same sort of signs or signifiers on people's faces. So like, you know, people go red with anger, that's a kind of culturally resonant, like global sort of phenomena. And also that they are evolutionary, so that we have evolved these basic emotions to serve certain kind of social and biological functions. You know, fear keeps us safe because it makes us run away or fight, the fight or flight kind of thing. And the classic ones are a sort of, you know, the originally Ekman formulated like 5 or 6 basic emotions. Since then, other scholars have elaborated his sort of original theories and added loads of others to the mix, like astonishment, awe, trepidation, boredom, and nostalgia. So if you ask most effective psychologists, so emotion or cognitive psychologists, so people who are interested in the science of emotions, they will mostly agree that nostalgia is, well, an emotion, but also a basic emotion, that it is something that everyone in the world feels. At some point or another, that it is, you know, kind of fundamental to being a kind of biological human, and that it is stable, so both across time and place. And so for them, nostalgia definitely is an emotion. I've definitely had some kind of discussions and debates with people about, well, yeah, is it an emotion, or is it kind of a, like, as you say, is it just sort of the act of memory, or is nostalgia like something else, a kind of feeling you attach on to a memory? Like, is it, you know, how does it kind of relate to thought? I suppose it kind of feels a bit kind of more complicated. I think it is an emotion, because I think that it is more than just a memory. You know, it is more than just like what you can call to mind when you think of a past event. You know, it's a kind of, you know, it's a feeling that, like, if you feel, like, for me anyway, nostalgia definitely kind of sits somewhere in the chest. You know, I kind of feel nostalgia a bit more like physically than it's just like, oh, I remember going, you know, to the beach with my family when I was 5 or whatever. And so it's this kind of, like, you know, sort of nice, crunchy, textury feeling thing that sits more in the body than in the brain. And that's my, I suppose, very unscientific, although I happen to agree with the scientists' model of what an emotion is, and we both agree that nostalgia is one.
Yeah, there's a romanticism to nostalgia, is there not? You know,
absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's what I think one of the things that's interesting about Inside Out, and the kind of whole plot, really, of Inside Out is them kind of figuring out. So joy is nice, right? Joy is good. Joy is a good feeling. Everyone likes joy. And then sadness is like bad. And so there's this sort of like certain way of thinking about emotions where we kind of code all of them. We kind of categorize all of them into like positives or negatives, like, oh, they're the good feelings and there are the bad feelings. Like, you know, and we kind of all might have a, like, a bit of an intuitive sense of like what the good ones, what the bad ones are. And in Inside Out, really the tussle is, and originally the idea is that sadness is bad. We want to have as little sadness as possible. We want to keep sadness down. Because when, you know, we want more joy, want more room for joy. And joy is very, like, kind of, frets a lot about sadness is like taking over some of her kind of space in the brain, as it were. But the resolution really of Inside Out, or one of the resolutions, is that actually you need a bit of sadness, that like sadness is a kind of good thing, and that it's not as straightforward as just having like good feelings and bad feelings, and that you need a kind of good, healthy mixture of both in order to be a kind of functioning human. Or at least you need to be a mixture of both to be a kind of adult, or kind of grow up to be a functioning human. And I think that's one of the things about nostalgia is that it gets a bad press, I would say, generally speaking. Like when we think about nostalgia in kind of political life, like especially very recently, people think it's not, it doesn't, you know, carry with it loads of great associations. But when you talk to psychologists and when you think about the nostalgia you yourself feel, it definitely has a kind of tinge of both, right? It's bittersweet. It's both like, you know, a longing, a wistfulness, a romanticism that can feel painful, like a sense of loss or regret. But it also can be nice to kind of wallow a bit in, you know, the warm bath of nostalgia, and it can make people feel good. So it's one of those things as well that I think sits nicely or kind of defies any easy categorization. It is both positive and negative, and neither and both at all the same time.
Yeah, I think that's maybe the power of this film, is how it complicates our feelings about feelings, right? I think the initial thought is, oh, sadness is bad. We want to avoid sadness in a very id kind of way, right? Like no, let's gravitate towards joy. And I think one of the powerful things about this film is like showing how sadness is a necessity, right? And I guess that's maybe how humans develop this emotion, how this becomes maybe a core thing, because joy is kind of awful to sadness to
yeah,
start.
She's mean. I know. And she's very like, you know, she also would be an absolute nightmare to be around, I think. Like, you know, she's really turns the, yeah, you're just like, all right, chill out. Okay. you know, she's real Pollyanna, like kind of sort of toxic positivity. You know, she's not good vibes, I think. And sadness isn't that fun either, but at least it would be chill if you had to hang out with sadness. You wouldn't be like exhausted all the time, which I think you definitely would be if you were spending time with joy. But yeah, I think that's obviously it's a film for, you know, it's not a film for people in their 30s and 40s. It is a film for kids. And like, you know, that's supposed to be, you know, that's the message, isn't it? That like, you know, it's good to feel. It's good to feel things, even if they didn't always feel good.
Yeah. You know, you bring up this point, like joy isn't very fun to be around, like 24/7, but neither was sadness, but neither would be fear or anger or disgust. And I think maybe that's the other thing. It's like, it's giving us this very meta commentary on how all of these pieces kind of balance one another out to form the whole, right? To form Riley, or to form my son or your son or anyone. It's just things like, hey, it's cool to feel, it's okay to feel all of these things. All of these things are composites of who you are. And they're giving this to us in a very real fashion. I did love seeing the variants of when we would, I didn't realize this first, when we went into the dad's head and they all had the mustaches.
Yeah,
it took me a second to realize that's where we were. You know, I was like,
yeah,
anchor is driving the boat here. So
I mean, that is the bits when you go into the parents' brains is definitely more of a kind of, is like very gendered, that like that whole bit when they're like not listening to anything, the mum, all the emotions in the dad's brain are just like not like tuned out of everything that the mum's saying. And then when the mum is like daydreaming about the like Brazilian boyfriend she had and stuff, you know, that is clearly like you're playing on a sort of like gentle bit of gender stereotyping there. But yeah, I think in a lighthearted way, it's still sweet. But yeah.
Well, they're giving us, we actually see nostalgia, right? Through the mom in the sepia tones with the Brazilian boyfriend.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So they didn't name it. We watched we both watched the trailer for Inside Out 2. Sadly, no nostalgia has been added, but
yet.
Maybe Inside Out 3. Maybe I'll be brought on as a consultant.
Oh, Inside Out 3 is when she's like 38 and going through a crisis. She's going through her first divorce and she's like thinking about all the things she should have done. Like, I should have gone to do this, or if I'd only followed my heart and gone with Jack, the whoever, right? So I think maybe Inside Out might be a thing where we age with this series. At least I'm hoping so, because I can't wait to see
how it goes.
Oh my gosh, are you kidding me? Like, one of the great lines in the end of this film is like, puberty. Oh, it's probably nothing. And we
plain sailing from here on out or something, isn't it? It's like, yeah, this is fine. We've got it nailed. Yeah. No, well, that is Inside Out 2, isn't it? When she's a teenager. Nightmare. Absolute nightmare.
I have a son who is 16. Mm-hmm. I have a son who is about to be 12. Yeah, it is an absolute nightmare. Like, it's just, I mean, I love my voice, obviously, but oh my God, it is, it's a lot.
Yeah. I was a terrible teenager. I put my parents through hell. It's amazing to me that they've forgiven me, because they have. And yeah, so I think that doesn't bode well for for my son, who's hopefully inherited more of his father's like easygoing temperament and less of my like door slamming and like teenage rage. So yeah, we'll see.
Only time will tell. We'll do a check in in about say 14 years and just,
we'll see how it goes.
As we come back to like the greatest hits of this. One of the interesting things, you brought this up a little bit earlier, and you talk about this in the book as well, this idea of like, and I had never even considered this, the idea about emotions being universal across cultures, or that some cultures don't have emotions and things like that. Can you speak to a little bit about that as well?
Yeah. So I've been kind of like alluding to this, but basically me as a historian, and I think most historians of emotion, although not all, don't really buy this idea that emotions are universal and evolutionary and standard across, I mean, you know, we're not really in the business of, you know, like global cultures. I'll leave that to the anthropologists, but definitely in terms of like the past, you know, we cannot know what people in the past felt, how they articulated those feelings. And we have to kind of assume that emotions have shifted across times. And, you know, there might be some commonalities or some kind of shared, you know, fundamental feelings perhaps, but that culture, language, social structures, all those things shape not just the way we articulate and communicate emotions, but also our internal lives and the feelings we have, you know, and how we feel things. And I think we've got a good, I think that's a kind of reasonable guess, I suppose, partly because we do know from, there is a lot of kind of anthropological research that suggests that emotions aren't standard across cultures. So I write a bit about this in my book, but this isn't my area of expertise. But so I write a bit about a historian called Thomas Dixon, who's here in the UK. He's worked a lot on the history of anger. And he writes about how there are communities, and again, he's sort of working with other people's research, but that there are communities in the Arctic, so Inuit communities, who don't have a term for anger. And anthropological research into those communities have found that they don't experience anger either. And anger is supposed to be, as Inside Out tells us, one of the kind of core fundamental basic emotions. It's supposed to be something that we all have. But even if something like that, something so core and supposedly fundamental, if that's not universal across time and place, then nostalgia surely is also more, you know, varied. And we know that different languages don't have exact cognate terms for nostalgia. And we know that some other languages have kind of similar concepts, or some other cultures will have kind of parallel or emotions that seem to share quite a lot with nostalgia, but aren't exactly the same. And I think that's one of the things that I find so compelling about writing a history of an emotion, is looking at how that emotion will have changed over time and in response to what social, cultural, or political or historical forces. And that's the thing that's, you know, so interesting to me, is like not just kind of mining the past for how we feel now, but also looking at how have we got to where we've got, I suppose, you know, how is that feeling transformed? And nostalgia has gone on quite a journey. So it's, you know, a particularly easy one in some ways to write about.
All right. I want to ask you, as we get nostalgic about this movie, I don't know, what are memories? Now we're going to complicate our own discussion. What are your favorite parts of this film? When you were watching this, when you were you were eager to say, yeah, let's absolutely talk about this. This movie is front and center in your book. What are your favorite parts of this film? What do you find that you relate to, that you really like what they're doing?
My favorite part of the book, my favorite part of the film is the bit where, so they have, I mentioned before, you know, they're like memories. So all these memories get stored in Riley's brain, and these little kind of orbs, glowing orbs, and they all get stacked up. And there's a bit where these people are going around, these like cleaners are going around in the deep memory bit of Riley's brain, sucking up all the memories that they don't think she's going to need. And they suck up all of her, they suck up like all of the presidents apart from like Abe Lincoln. They like suck up, you know, all these phone numbers apart from like one from her like childhood friend or whatever. And they do this, and they also suck up like all this like useful stuff, basically. But then they leave this jingle that just kind of then plagues the rest of the film. And I just thought that was so funny. It's not a particularly profound favorite bit, but it's just like so good. And I really, my own memory is terrible. It's got like worse and worse. I'm like not a good, don't have great recall. And so I was like, yes, that's, I feel, yeah. You know, I was like, oh yeah, I can remember, you know, I can remember my like landline phone number from when I was six, but I can't remember anything like actually useful, like, you know, or who am I supposed to email, or like, you know, what my plans are for the coming week. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I like the idea that there is someone going around in my brain hoovering up stuff, because then at least it's not my fault.
Oh my gosh, I worry all the time that I've got like early onset Alzheimer's, because I can't remember. People ask me about HATM and they're like, well, what movie did you do last week? And I sit here and I go, I don't know. Like, that was 3 days ago or something like that. However, if you ask me about something that happened in Florida in 1765, oh yeah, I can tell you how, like, I can tell you the time and temperature, you know, of like a given Wednesday, you know? So it's a maddening thing for me as a historian. Like I can remember all this old stuff. I can't begin to tell you what I did last week.
I think it's a very like kind of, you know, it's a kind of common like model, I suppose, for thinking about memory, is that you need to like free up space on the hard drive to like get new stuff in. Yeah. And if your hard drive is just like backed up with loads of old shit, then like you're never going to have to get any of that new things. You know, yeah, like I could talk, you know, I know all of this stuff about like, you know, my PhD, which is on 19th century cancer, like all this stuff about like, you know, some random obscure doctor in 1860s London or whatever, his name, his wife's name, all this. I'm never going to use that again. And yet, you know, I can't seem to get it loose. I need to free up some real estate for some useful things. But
oh my gosh, I feel the exact same way, because I use that model the entire time. I'm like, I'm literally pushing things out of my brain as I'm pushing, but I can't choose what I want to remember.
No.
So that's a maddening thing. You're absolutely, it's so funny. The parts of this film that drove you nuts, were there parts that you that made you that were maddening to you? Were the things that you wanted to see?
I don't know. I just loved it. I mean, I do think, you know, I do think that I don't find it frustrating, but it puts across this model of emotions that I think is kind of reductive, I suppose, because, you know, it's a kid film. Can't be, you know, that's very tedious and you know, academic of you to be like, how dare you not have, you know. But I do wish it had a bit more of a kind of, I just think it's, I suppose it's more that I think it just confirms what everybody thinks. And I'd love there to be other kind of bits of popular culture out there that deal with these sorts of alternative models of emotion, so that people can get a bit more of a range of views sort of injection of them. But I think it's a pretty perfect film. I just really, really love it.
It's so, so good. And I think I'm expecting, because we've seen the trailer for Inside Out 2, the introduction of new emotions. And I'm kind of wondering if, as Riley becomes older and more self-aware and more aware of the world around her, that we'll see kind of the development of more complex feelings about those worlds around her.
Yeah.
Maybe,
yeah,
that's where definitely we'll get that.
Yeah. I mean, they're getting in, one of the ones that they're getting in is anxiety. And that will be, yeah. I mean, that felt very, I felt, that felt a bit close to the bone.
Very near, dear to the heart.
Yeah, yeah. But that's an interesting one as well. You know, that's one of those emotions as well that, like, historians think is a kind of relatively recent phenomenon, like, because it seems so tied up, especially, like, anxiety and stress. You know, they're kind of such products of, like, the kind of hectic pace of life, the way we kind of interact and articulate and medicate those things as well. That is, you know, obviously, not to say that people didn't feel a sense of trepidation or worry in a kind of, you know, pre-modern world, but that those things were articulated and conceptualized very differently. And so that probably then shaped the way they were experienced as well. And so, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see, we could do this again when someone else writes, I'm sure someone's written a book, A History of Anxiety, that you should bring them on and get them to chat about Inside Out 2. And I'll come along and just, you know, listen.
Oh. Listen, historians are obviously drawn to anxiety because of the historical job market. Are you kidding me? So, you know, so there's all we have to do is hop on Twitter and we can see anxiety as
full of expression. Dread. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. All right. I have to ask you, because I was watching this and enjoying the film, thinking, oh my gosh, I really love this movie. It clips along. You're done in 95 minutes, which is beautiful for me because I have to watch so many movies now. I was not prepared for the discussion about Bing Bong. And more to the point, for how I felt about watching Bing Bong, and I was like, oh my God, this character is going to make me cry, isn't he? Can we talk about Bing Bong?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, he's lovely. It's obviously great. It's obviously, I mean, that's, yeah. So, well, if anyone's not watched it, Bing Bong's her imaginary friend who, do you do spoilers on this podcast? I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah, this movie is like, what, 9 years old? It kind of amazes me it took us 9 years to get a sequel.
Yeah, if someone's listening to this and they've not seen it, they're probably like, yeah, it's on them. Yeah, and then, you know, he's lost. And that's, you know, a real tragedy. But I suppose that is also that thing of like, you know, oh, well, it's a real, you know, it's a coming of age film, isn't it? It's about like shedding these like childhood simplicity, that kind of simple dichotomy between joy and sadness, about getting rid of. But, you know, what I think is lovely about Bing Bong is that he's not seen as like, I mean, he is silly. He's like a silly character, but he's not disparaged. You know, he plays a really important role in the film. He plays a really important role in Riley's life and of like bringing Riley back to safety, bringing everything back together. And I think that's really nice that, like, you know, so often childhood feelings or like childhood experiences can be really dismissed or kind of, you know, belittled, infantilized, you know, trivialized. And I just think it's lovely that like Bing Bong is actually, you know, the hero that saves the day, even though he's, you know, also like a real hallmark of infancy. I think it's, yeah, it's a really nice, you know, I think it's lovely. If you imagine if you're 11 watching that film or younger and you have your own imaginary friend, and that's definitely going to be a bittersweet experience because you're both going to maybe anticipate his eventual loss, but you're also going to see how important he is to you. Very moving, very lovely bit of the film.
Are you kidding me? Imagine if you're 46 watching this movie and thinking, oh my gosh, did I abandon my imaginary friend?
No.
What was their name? What did they look like?
I know. Well, but yeah. But the thing is that you can also feel confident that, you know, he did or she did their duty. You know, they did the right thing. And that's really nice too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we're going to go to like these next levels, it's almost like the imaginary friend serves this role to get you socially to the next level.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's also like, you know, what all of these emotions are about, really, is that they're all about like kind of social interaction. And you've got an imaginary friend, you're like practicing all of those like social interactions, prepping you for this terrifying world of teenagedom and adolescence. So you have to like actually navigate like other humans, which is, you know, done with mixed success, I would say, in most teenage people's lives, and definitely my own teenage years. He's Bing Bong. It's a great bit of a film. Great.
You know, now I'm starting to imagine like this discourse actually over imaginary friends. There's a new film coming out called If with Ryan Reynolds. Have you seen the trailers for this? Mm-hmm. I'll have to send this to you. It's a whole new thing about Ryan Reynolds' divorced dad and his daughter trying to save their imaginary friend's world.
Yeah.
Not unlike in some ways Monsters, Inc., where the whole
another great film.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, so good.
Kitten. Did you ever see there was a movie that came out in the 80s with Howie Mandel called Little Monsters? Do you know this film at all?
Huh?
Another one where the monsters are supposed to be the scary thing, but turn out to be the best friends. I have to see this as well. So I'm now wondering about this whole discourse about the role of imaginary friends and the formation of the childhood psyche. We're going to come back to this when we do Monsters, Inc. I'm going to beg you to come back on so we can,
all right,
we
can, well, do this. I do. There is a kind of strange connection, not to keep banging on about nostalgia, but there is a sort of strange connection with nostalgia, because one of the things that I found, I sort of discovered for myself, my kind of weirdest kind of episode in nostalgia's history was it had this sort of weird tie-in with poltergeists in the 1930s. So there was this psychoanalyst called Nandor Fodor, who was Hungarian, and he was really into psychoanalysis. So, you know, obviously already slightly suspect, but also really into the paranormal. And he thought that you could build a new academic discipline that kind of blended the two things together. And he wasn't alone in thinking this, but he basically thought that poltergeists were kind of like imaginary friends, that they were, you know, they were mostly seen by young people, like kids and adolescents, and that they were kind of a projection of the psyche outwards, that like you would only, that something had gone wrong, something had kind of like, there'd been some sort of like emotional aberration, and they weren't adjusting to adult or like growing up very well. And so they kind of externalized their psyche and they kind of invented these poltergeists, which kind of are like imaginary friends that speak to them and do stuff. And, you know, and he thought that nostalgia was basically very similar, that only kind of slightly defective people or people who weren't managing their feelings very well or weren't managing growing up very well, especially people who were like kind of struggling to like, you know, cut the apron strings, you know, people who couldn't, who felt like too, like couldn't really leave the family home. They were the people who were like the chronic nostalgics, the really like prone to nostalgia. And they were pretty like both sort of, you know, they didn't have any, they weren't emotionally altogether. They weren't kind of developing emotionally normally. That nostalgia is like a slightly suspect emotion to be have in any like large, in large doses. So nostalgia, poltergeists and imaginary friends, all bad signs for someone's like psychological life, and also all kind of the same things and all kind of emerge around the same sort of time, like childhood, early adolescence, which, you know, is kind of weird, but you do sort of still get little echoes of that kind of quite disparaging view of nostalgia kind of around today. That, you know, that intellectual, progressive people, smart people aren't nostalgic. I think there's still that kind of slight implication in some, sometimes when people write about it, even now, although they obviously, they don't know anything about Nandor Fodor, they haven't necessarily read his work. But I think there is still that little bit flying around, you know, in sort of the New York Times discourse around Trump voters, for example. You get it a little bit. But yeah, but that was weird. I thought that was strange. He has this whole like kind of very strange set of theories. I mean, that's one of the best things though about being a historian of, well, I mean, of anything, but of kind of science and medicine and stuff, is that such weird stuff. You know, people come up with such what, have such wild ideas, and not all of it lasts, but it's always really good to kind of get stuck into it.
Well, I actually want to dive in on nostalgia. I'm going to come back to nostalgia even more here because I'm fascinated with this, the idea of like writing the history of an emotion, but you're doing more in this book than say just writing the history of emotion. You're really kind of using this emotion as a vehicle in a lot of ways, as a lens to kind of talk about, you know, a lot of different aspects as far as like society, or regret, dislocation, work and industry, like politics and fear and anxiety. Like, how do you use an emotion to write about these things? I am fascinated how you took this thing and used it as this mechanism to understand other things. Like, how does that happen?
Great question. Well, so nostalgia is a great emotion to do this with because it has changed so much. So, as I'm sure lots of people know, nostalgia, the term, was coined in 1688 by a Swiss physician called Johannes Hofer. And it basically was, for him and for his kind of fellow physicians, a disease, and a disease that had the capacity to kill people. So it wasn't just an emotion, but it was a diagnosis. And it was also quite different to the emotion we now know and love. Nostalgia now, obviously, is a kind of longing, regret, wistful feeling about a past time, so like your childhood or something else. Whereas in the 17th century, nostalgia was a kind of like pathological homesickness. So it was a place-based emotion or a place-based sickness. And he first identified it specifically in mercenaries, so soldiers who'd been sent away from home to fight abroad, in domestic servants, so people, again, who'd been sent away from home to work elsewhere, and in university students, so anyone who'd, again, left home and gone and studied somewhere else. And he thought it was incredibly concerning disease, had been really understudied, not been taken seriously by the medical community. And, you know, he had all these sort of theories about its causes, its characteristics, possible cures. But fundamentally, the only way to cure nostalgia at this point was to send people back home. Like, you couldn't, you know, most people wouldn't survive unless they returned home. And it kind of stays, it has some twists, interesting twists and turns, but basically it stays like this until the beginning of the 20th century. And then at the beginning of the 20th century, it slowly mutates, morphs into this thing we now know it to be. And in the process sheds a lot of its, it sheds a lot of its threat, sort of, you know, well, existential threat, I suppose. But it retains, I think, some of that kind of worrying. This is why it's called, the book is called A History of a Dangerous Emotion, because it was literally dangerous. And then now it has other kinds of more subtle and more diffuse, but still has an element of danger to it, which is always fun. And I think the thing that I was trying to get at in the book, or trying to kind of do with the book, is to think, okay, well why did nostalgia change like that? What was it responding to? What shaped it? And then in turn, what did nostalgia do to the world? So what did people's experience, so this is, you know, you think of an emotion as a, you know, as internal, individual, you know, that you're kind of looking in on your own feelings. Like, why would that be something that would necessarily be a historical agent? You know, like, it seems sort of like a weird exercise in like, it seems a bit sort of silly in some ways to say like, oh, well, we can explain the French Revolution because of all the rage that was going on. You know, I think that would be a reductive argument. So I don't make that argument. And the book is fundamentally not an exercise in trying to kind of psychobiography. So I'm not about saying like, well, this guy in 1767 or whatever, he was nostalgic and that made him do X, Y, Z. Like, that's not what this book is about, because I think we can't know that, right? We can't know actually how people felt. But what we can do is look at how people instrumentalized nostalgia as a way of justifying certain approaches to things, about how they used it to kind of analyze the world and think about, you know, what was going on. So one of the examples I write a bit about in the book, and this is the kind of the most of the book is quite lighthearted, right? And this is like very much a not a lighthearted bit of the book, where I write about nostalgia amongst the enslaved. So people who were captured in West Africa, transported across to the Americas into slavery. And nostalgia was a very common diagnosis made among the enslaved. So it was seen as an explanation for why a lot of enslaved people took their own lives, both in transit, but also when they arrived in the Americas. And, you know, in some ways it can feel very flippant. You know, as a modern reader, you might read that and be like, that feels very flippant that people were sort of diagnosing, you know, saying, oh, well, they were succumbing to nostalgia. But obviously it carried a different kind of weight and severity then. And what's interesting to me is both the people who, some people who are writing about, some, well, white, European mostly, some American physicians who were writing about this kind of epidemic of nostalgia in this context were doing it because they were saying, well, you know, they were doing it because they were abolitionists. And they said, look, this is evidence of complex emotion. This is evidence that, and especially since nostalgia had first been diagnosed as something, or first been conceptualized as something that seemed to predominate in Switzerland, in Austria, in France, you know, a product of, you know, it's a rarefied European emotion, right? It's something that is like, you know, and so then if you are drawing commonality between the experiences of people in Europe and the people who were sold into chattel slavery, that is, you know, that is an indicator that they were trying to paint a more positive, nuanced, in-depth view of the inner lives, the interiority of people of color at a time when often that interiority was minimized. But then you also have people who see nostalgia, this epidemic of nostalgia, as an economic problem, and saying, okay, well, if nostalgia is deadly, we are losing a lot of our stock through this emotion. This is really bad. How can we think more carefully and critically about, you know, how can we correct this problem, not for their sake, but for our sake as capitalists, as slave traders? And that, I think, is, you know, an indicator of both like how an emotion can be, how a kind of category can be deployed to different ends, but also fascinating insight into how different, how emotions and diseases can be used to underscore and also complicate social and racial and political hierarchies that we, and we see this, we talk about this a lot now, right, about like how some people, some communities, some people have greater access to some feelings and not others. So we tend to, you know, be very characterized, you know, the angry black woman. And that's a kind of very dismissive and undermining stereotype. And that some, you know, white men have more kind of access in some ways to like rage or stridency, that doesn't diminish them in the same way that it might undermine the claims of a woman, or particularly a woman of color. And I think that, you know, nostalgia also can do that sort of hierarchizing or hierarchizing or something, I don't know. And that is a big part of the book, is looking at how, not so much how emotions are felt, but how they are instrumentalized and how narratives around emotions can kind of lay into very familiar or complicated or nuanced, very familiar stories about history and takes in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, you know, as you're talking, and I'm thinking about my own experiences, I've moved around a lot as an adult. You know, and I left Kentucky, where I'm from originally, you know, when I was 20, 21 years old, for very real reasons. It was very small town, very conservative, very religious. I'm none of those things. And the longer I'm away from Kentucky, and I find myself in some ways fighting off the ill effects of nostalgia in some ways, because I will start to fantasize or romanticize about how good life was in Kentucky, about the summers I spent there and all these. And I wonder, Agnes, if there's in the contemporary context about selective memory and its role in forming nostalgia, because I think about my grandfather, who I loved dearly. And then I go home back to Kentucky. And within 2.5 days, I am clawing at the doors to get out as fast as I possibly can, because the reality does not fit.
Absolutely. I mean, that is essentially what nostalgia is, right? It's a kind of partial or imperfect memory. I mean, all of our memories, you know, human memory is bad, right? We're very bad at accurately recalling the past. That is one of our like kind of fundamental, that's just true, right? When all of us are bad at it. We've talked a bit about our own like poor memories, but everyone's bad at remembering actually how things happened. And that's because, you know, our memories are fallible and they are constructions as much as they are like accurate or like sort of facsimiles of what's actually happened. And nostalgia is that like on acid, right? It is totally about, it's a rose-tinted view of the past, right? And it is totally selective, totally partial. And that's one of the big criticisms, right, that people levy at it, is that now when people are, you know, like in Britain, you know, there's a huge amount of nostalgia for kind of like the post-war period of like, you know, all the good old days of like, you know, when men were men and women were women, and, you know, the kind of domestic kind of idyll of like all that sort of stuff, or like, you know, when people... and children played outside and, you know, everyone was white and all this kind of stuff. Like, those are the kinds of nostalgic visions of the past that come under the most critique, because they are not just obviously offensive, or rather kind of reductive, or kind of tell us a very kind of incomplete story of the past, but they also are wrong, right? Like, society wasn't like that. You're misremembering, you know, if you're talking about the 50s and 60s, you know, you could have a very nostalgic vision of society then and say, oh, it was great, it was wonderful, it was lovely. Or you can say, okay, this is a time when, you know, women weren't able to procure their own divorces. They weren't able to have their own bank accounts, that, you know, that businesses were allowed to discriminate along racial lines completely unimpeded by the law. You know, there's all these things that were like bad. And if you're nostalgic for a time period in history, as historians, we know, right, that, you know, there's lots of bad, even with, you know, any good comes with like a bucket full of bad as well. And that's the whole point of being a historian, right? Is that you're about like being detached and objective about a time period in the past and say, and looking at it kind of warts and all and saying, you know, this isn't all roses. There's lots of stuff about that. It's good that we've left those things behind. And that if you, that's why people are a bit suspect of people are really nostalgic now, because it's like, oh, well, you're just kind of, it's a fantasy, and that tells us more about how you want the world to be now than it does about like how the world actually was, right? It's you're projecting, you're not remembering. And that I think is really interesting kind of aspect of nostalgia that I like to sort of think about and write about.
Yeah, there's a whole other podcast now that is entirely devoted to nostalgia and its own effect on how we remember interpersonal relationships as well. Yeah,
definitely. Well, I mean, that's what, so psychologists now think that nostalgia is like basically was evolved in order to embed, to strengthen social bonds. That its whole point that we have it is because it's a social emotion, and that usually when people are nostalgic about something, they're nostalgic about a peopled past. They're not nostalgic about a non-peopled past. And so it is supposed to make you feel more connected. And people now, psychologists now, are very positive about nostalgia. And they say, actually, you know, it's a really good thing to feel, because it makes you feel more connected. It makes you feel more sociable. It makes you feel more loved. It can be good, you know, evoking nostalgia in people can be a kind of treatment. It can make people feel better, more emotionally healthy, happy, less depressed, less anxious, all of those things. And, you know, I can kind of see that, right? Like, it is, when you think back to, if you can remember a time when you felt loved and connected, then even if you feel sad or wistful that might have gone, at least you know you have the potential to recreate that in the future, right? There's a kind of like also can tell you something positive about your own capacity for love and connection, which is, you know, good, not just bad.
It's a human feeling, right?
Yeah. Messy. Yeah. Complicated. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yes. Right? And that's what, God, I love this movie so much. Like, I can't, I'm going to watch it again. As soon as I recover from Bing Bong. Like, I'm still not there.
No ready to get back.
I'm ready to be heard again. Let me ask you, Agnes, are there scholars, are there books that really influenced the development of this particular book when you think about, like, when you were starting to conceptualize what nostalgia was going to be in a very memory-centric and not nostalgia-oriented way? Who are the people that influenced your work? What else should we be reading?
Wow, great question. I mentioned him before, but Thomas Dixon, he's still a professor at Queen Mary, but he's actually done the most admirable thing and left academia and he's still got a foot in, to be retrained as a primary school teacher. I think that's, you know, great. But he's done amazing work on sort of conceptualizing what an emotion is, what the history of emotion is. He does that work on anger that I talked about. And I found that, and I used to work with him at Queen Mary, and he's, you know, a great person as well. That always helps. He's been really influential on my work. On the book specifically, I would really recommend reading a book by Susan J. Matt, which is Homesickness in American History, especially, you know, if you're American or you're interested in American history. That's really great. And that has a lot of the arguments I make about, there's a chapter in the book about homesickness. A lot of the arguments I make in that are indebted to her work. And that's a really great book. Tells a really interesting story about how homesickness, which, you know, now is a kind of, you know, a bit like imaginary friends, is a kind of like infantilized, trivialized, like something that only like kids, you know, it's sort of seen as a bit silly to be homesick, right? And then she writes about how in the past, in the 19th century, it was a noble, virtuous condition that showed, you know, sort of that you were committed to like the fatherland or the homeland. And then due to the forces of capitalism, colonialism, the need for an increasingly mobile workforce, homesickness was diminished. There's a case to be made for resurrecting homesickness as like a kind of, you know, partly because I get very homesick, a bit like your kind of talk about Kentucky. I've done a very poor job of leaving my hometown of London, and always get very, you know, I used to be as a kid really homesick. I found it really tough. And now I'm a bit better at managing it, but I moved to Montreal for a year in 2021. So kind of in the midst of the pandemic, and I was so homesick. And it was lovely. You know, there was nothing wrong with the, other than, you know, the world falling apart, but there was nothing wrong with my new home, my new job. And I'd gone with my husband, so it wasn't like I was even that alone, but I was just I was really sad about missing my parents and my friends and stuff. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe we need to like rehabilitate homesickness a little bit as well, if only for my sake.
We were just talking before we went on the air how eager I am to return to Florida, right? And the second I get home, I will start complaining about the heat, the bugs, the humidity, the traffic, the people from Jersey, everything, you know. So there with you.
I feel though about London, like, because I really, you know, I'm very committed. I think it's the best city in the world, but I'm also the only one who's allowed to complain about it. So if anyone who like comes here and starts moaning about it, I'm like, no, how dare you, it's the best city. But then I'm allowed to talk about the tourists and the transport and the pollution and the expense, you know, that's fine, but no one else is allowed to make those same
comments. Good. Well, that's good, because as a man of English descent, I still feel like I should be able to return back and make commentary, but qualified commentary on my ancestral homelands.
Brits love it when Americans come to the UK and talk about how.
Are you serious?
No.
Oh no!
It's like
I didn't choose to leave. It was my ancestors.
I'm sorry, Brits are really horrible and rude. I'm really sorry, but they will be. They won't say anything to your face. They'll be very nice to your face.
Fine.
But behind your back, they'll be like, ugh, "These Americans." That's the vibe. I love Americans. You wouldn't hear it from me. But
I have a homesickness towards England. I'm just saying, yeah. It's not grounded. So now you can be like, this guy, he's awful.
No, I mean, I think that's very common, actually, though, is that thing of like, really? You know, people do feel a kind of weird, you know, that feeling of being homesick for a place you've never been, or being nostalgic for a time you never actually lived in is very common. There's a bit in, the book, where I look at, there's a living history museum in England called Blist's Hill, which is it's supposed to be like an 1890s town that they've reconstructed, and you can go and visit it and go in the shops and, you know, a bit like kind of colonial Williamsburg or like a Renaissance fair, that kind of thing. And it's really interesting. I went through all of the reviews on TripAdvisor of this place, and all these people, so it's 1890s, right? And all these people are like, oh, it made me feel so nostalgic. Oh, the good old days. Oh, it made me think about my childhood. I'm like, none of you people are 120. So there's no way you could have remember. You can't remember this, and yet people still feel. And the same. I also did a little look at. Do you know medieval times?
Oh yes, there's one in Orlando.
Yeah, I think that's the first one. Maybe the first American one was in Orlando. Anyway,
medieval times outside the U.S.
It was originated in Spain. The first medieval times, were in Benidorm and Malaga, I think. And then they were like, okay, well, this is going to work better for an American audience. And then obviously it did. And I think there's one in Toronto, so there's a Canadian outpost as well.
Okay.
But yeah, it's obviously an American. I've never been, but I know all about it. And they all the similar, like those are the reviews of it, are like, oh, I feel so nostalgic that, you know, everyone gets, I get called lady and, you know, lord and all this sort of stuff. I'm like, you're nostalgic for the medieval, well, a kind of pastiche of the medieval period? Like, you're American. It's so weird. I know. It's like absolutely bizarre. And, you know, I think that is, I mean, it's a common, and I also felt it so much as a child. I mean, one of the big motivations for writing this book is that I am a terrible nostalgic. Especially for periods of the past that I never lived in. So I didn't have an imaginary friend as a child, but I was really into kind of imagining myself, you know, imagining stories for myself and like kind of, you know, sort of, yes. I have siblings, but I kind of had a bit of a sort of only child sort of slight vibes, you know, like a bit kind of solitary, a bit weird. And I just sort of think about, imagine myself, my life as though I was in the 1930s.
If I had only,
yeah,
I was saying this last night, I was born in the wrong time. I was born in the wrong place.
Yeah. And I've lost a lot of, you know, being a professional historian kind of inoculates against a lot of that, I think. But as a kid, I was like really into it. And I loved, and I think that is kind of what got me into history, really, is that even though, you know, it was in some ways the very worst thing for it, it really, I was like so into the past. And now I know better, but like at the time I was so nostalgic for something I'd never experienced and something I'd basically invented, you know, I'd kind of imagined what it might be like. And it was a lot of it was based on like historical novels rather than actual historical, you know, knowledge. I was really into Georgette Heyer, you know, the kind of, do you know, what's it called? Renaissance, the kind of Bridgerton era, Georgian era. There we go. Romance fiction, basically. I was really into that.
Please. Like, you're talking to the man who is the most unlikely Downton Abbey fan in the entire world.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you're keen on England, it's real, you know, it's like real concentrated, like, you know, English nostalgia, I suppose. I mean, there's a lot of nostalgia in the fandom for Downton Abbey, I think.
Well, I'm told they love Americans who come over and claim their ancestry. So, you know, there's that. you answered this great question that I had, actually, which is I wonder if it's nostalgia that draws so many of us into history as a profession. Or so many listeners who just, you know, casually like listening to history or things like that. Like, I always say that everyone's a historian of their own life's experience, but I wonder the role of this imagined reality that draws us in.
I'm sure there's lots of historians listening who'd be like, no, I'd never be nostalgic. How dare you?
They're wrong.
But I think that, I mean, I do think that it is an incredibly powerful feeling. And I think that, you know, it does. And I also think that, I mean, I absolutely think that it is very powerful. It's a very powerful allure for people interested in kind of non-professional or non-academic forms of like history making and history play, like reenactments and Renaissance fairs and living history museums and heritage, you know, the heritage industry in general. I think nostalgia is a big part of that world. And I think that that's a good thing. I think that one of the things that academic historians can be very snooty about is when people are nostalgic. And I think, you know, we've got to, there's a line to be drawn. And I think it can be clouding as well as illuminating. But I think that there is nothing wrong with finding the past. There's nothing wrong with feeling an emotional connection to the past. And if an emotion like nostalgia is what brings people into history, then I think we should be like in favor of that. I think that is a good thing. And I think that there is, I think we should be less serious as academic historians about history, apart from anything else. I mean, I think we should be serious about it in the right kind of circumstances, in the right sort of context, right? Obviously, it does matter a huge amount, and there are very good examples of when it is no laughing matter. But I think that doesn't apply everywhere. And I think if nostalgia brings people in and encourages people to like enjoy the past and play with the past and kind of luxuriate in it, then I think that is both a good thing, because I like people to have fun and have a good time and enjoy things. I think that's good. I like joy. And also because I think that it is good for us as academic historians, because it keeps our profession alive. It keeps us being relevant and of, you know, interest and of use to people outside the academy. So I'm both pro on a kind of humane, like general, you know, genuine level, and also pro on a kind of cynical, self-interested level. You know, I want people to be interested in history because I want people to buy my books. So, you know, I'm, you know, I think it's,
I want to feed my child.
Exactly.
Yes.
I have bills to pay. And if nostalgia is going to help with that, then I've got no problem with it. But yeah, I'm
pro. Yes, I remember I had bills to pay. So there was that. That's my insight. Oh my gosh, that's just perfect. All right, Agnes, let me ask you maybe our big final question, because what you just said was just, I wish I could frame it. Is Inside Out a history movie?
It's a great question. I think, I mean, I'm going to do the classic academic response and say yes and no. I think yes, because it's definitely a history of emotions movie. I think anyone who is interested in the history of emotions has to watch it, because it does a really good job of thinking through, and I think it'd be a great movie to teach with. It does a really good job of capturing sometimes quite tricky psychological concepts, right? And I think that is really good. It's good at that. I think it, yes, also because it is a snapshot of a moment in time, right? Like, you know, this is a bit of a loose definition of a history movie, because by that definition, all films are history movies because they all capture a particular moment in the past. But I do think that it captures a particular sort of set of emotional assumptions. And there is this idea that we should have both good and bad feelings, that we should talk about our feelings, that we should make space for sadness, that we should take emotion seriously as part of childhood development. It's obviously a kind of a product of a very particular historical moment and a product of a very particular kind of set of trends in psychology and mental health in the way that we articulate feelings. And I think it will, you know, be a very important historical source in the future. And then obviously no, because it's actually not about history at all, right? It's about it's about a little girl and her feelings. And it's a kid's film that is like makes no claims to being kind of historical in that sense. So yeah, maybe that's not the most, maybe I could probably think about that question, you know, for weeks and have maybe a better answer, but that's what I'm going to go with right now.
We'll think about it until we come back to do the sequel.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Where can people find you in the present, online, so forth? They want to learn more about your work, your book. Where can people find you?
Well, you can buy my book. We can pre-order my book, depending on when this is going to come out. It's published.
It's coming out in April. We're going to push this book.
Okay, great. It's coming out on the 25th of April. You can buy it in all good and bad bookshops. It's being published by Picador, Pan Macmillan, so you can get it direct from their website if you want to pre-order it. And you can find me all the time, all day long, on X, formerly known as Twitter. And I am Agnes Juliet, AGNESJULIET. But also, if you Google me, there's only one of me, so that's quite handy. I've got a kind of complicated double-barreled surname, and that means that there's only, you know, I'm quite easy to find. But yeah, definitely on Twitter or, you know, in books. Those are the places you can find me.
Oh, Agnes, I was so looking forward to talking to you today. I am so glad that you took the time. I know it's a little bit later over in England, in London, today on a Sunday. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and talk to us. This has been a blast. This is awesome. Come back.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I had a great time. Yeah, I've got to go put the baby to bed now. That's my next task. But yeah, a lot less fun than this, I can tell you.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so much to our guest, Agnes Arnold Forster. Agnes, you were the coolest person. I loved talking to you today. You were absolutely amazing. Please come back on the pod as soon as you possibly can. This was such a cool conversation. Thank you, of course, to our producer, Fletcher Powell, for making this show happen, for doing the work and all that to bring this to you guys. And of course, as always, thank you to everybody who is listening to this right now, who has continued to listen to this pod for the last almost a year and a half now as we've launched this out, who continues to share this, leaving comments on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, listening to the Substack. You guys can continue to support this by just sharing this on social media, telling your friends and even your enemies, hell, even your in-laws, about the pod. It means the world to us. So thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed this. This was a blast. I've got some more stuff coming for you soon. Talk to you a little bit later. Ciao for now.